This episode is brought to you by Curie Briefs, the smartest 3-minute read in medicine. Think of it like mental floss for busy clinicians. Sharp, concise, and clinically relevant. Check it out today at Curie.md. And now, on to the show.
America spends nearly $5 trillion a year on healthcare. That's more than any other country on Earth. But if you ask patients, doctors, or employers whether they feel they're getting their money's worth, the answer is almost always no. Costs keep climbing, access keeps shrinking, and everyone on the front lines feels the squeeze. Today's guest says that's not an accident. It's a heist. Chris Deacon is a lawyer turned health plan reformer who once ran one of the largest public health plans in the country. Her new book, The Great American Healthcare Heist, Why We're Paying More and Getting Less, pulls back the curtain on the deals, the middlemen, and the incentives that make our system more expensive while patients and clinicians get less. In our conversation, we talk about what's being taken, how it shows up in the daily practice of medicine, and what it will take to rebuild a system that actually serves the people working in it and the people relying on it. Chris Deacon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm so fascinated by your background because you're a lawyer by training, but you also ended up leading benefits for hundreds of thousands of public sector employees in New Jersey. How did that happen?
Well, it definitely wasn't planned. When I left law school, I thought I would take sort of the more typical path. I went to a firm. I was a law clerk for a few years. I was in private practice. I know that public service was always sort of in my blood and a calling. So I found myself at the Attorney General's office after private practice, which then led to an opportunity within the Christie administration, where I really sort of got more involved into the health benefits space and healthcare, as I oversaw Department of Banking and Insurance and Department of Treasury. And when that administration ended from term limits, that's when I moved over to the treasurer's office. And my immediate home was running the state health benefits program. And I have to say, at the time, I did not realize what I was necessarily getting into. But it was a tremendous honor. And I still, it was one of the biggest and best jobs of my lifetime thus far, and an incredible honor to serve those that serve us.
Yeah, when you think back to that experience, what did you learn from that role, whether it was about yourself or even just about the healthcare system?
Yeah, probably one of the most important lessons was that, when you sit at those tables with, 20 executives from different healthcare entities, and you ask really straightforward, or what I thought were straightforward and simple questions, you have to question the answers. They might have been in this business for 30 years, but, when you ask a consultant why you would ever buy something off of a discount without knowing the price, the underlying price, I was looked at like I was the crazy one. But I learned that you had to ask those hard questions, and I sort of gained confidence in doing that. And I still do that. Ask the hard questions.
You've since launched your own consulting firm, Versant Consulting, and written 2 books, which we'll get to in just a second. But before we get there, what motivated you to go from operating inside the system to writing about it and trying to fix it from the outside?
Yeah, so in 2021, there was, we were involved in some contract negotiations, let's say, contract issues with our third-party administrator at the time. And I was essentially presented with a choice. I could sort of stop rabble-rousing internally because it was politically disruptive to, you know, whether it was the hospital association or Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield. You know, I could sort of keep my head down and not call balls and strikes and keep on that career path, or I could follow my sort of moral compass. And so that's what I chose to do. I left and, you know, tried to make those changes more broadly across the system.
Let's talk about your new book. It's titled The Great American Healthcare Heist, and I love the name. But for our clinicians listening who may not see all the contracts and behind-the-scenes deals, what exactly is being stolen in this Great American Healthcare Heist?
Yeah, I chose the word heist because a heist is something that's very well planned and deliberate, and you know, everybody has their role, and you don't realize the heist has happened until it's too late. And so I thought heist was the perfect descriptor for what we're currently experiencing in the healthcare system, because, you know, let's take employees and employers, for example. You know, the average family PPO plan this year, I think, was north of $36,000. And that's being taken out of wages and being taken out of, you know, being put towards other productive uses for an employer. You know, when it comes to clinicians, we see moral injury. We see, you know, more extraction towards administrative bloat and the third parties that sit in the middle and the highest, you know, ranking executives in some of these agencies, not to mention the profit levels of, you know, some of the bigger companies like United Healthcare. So yeah, I mean, I think that they're, everybody's sort of getting their take. It's very well orchestrated. You know, I think on the surface, you see a little bit of kabuki theater with, you know, PBMs versus pharma and hospitals versus carriers. But at the end of the day, they all have an interest in making that $4.9 trillion pie bigger. That's what our healthcare spend is as a nation. You know, so they're sort of all on the take. And there's a certain amount of political graft as well. So yeah, that's why I thought heist was the right word.
Yeah, very articulate. And how does this heist then show up in the daily practice of physicians and their treatment of patients?
Yeah, I mean, in a number of ways, and I won't be able to articulate all of them, but I'll give you a few examples. One of the most, you know, sort of egregious, I would say, is some behavior that really came to light in a lawsuit in California. And I won't go into the details of the lawsuit, but suffice it to say, for some out-of-network claims, providers were receiving less than 30% of the healthcare dollar that the employer was spending. On one claim alone, an employer paid $4 million for a high-cost claimant. Out of that $4 million, the clinician, the provider in that case, received $875,000, whereas Cigna and MultiPlan, the middlemen, you know, kept $3 million collectively. That's not healthcare, right? And so it is, you know, that's an example of part of the heist, like what's being taken in the middle. I also think that to a certain extent, we are not aware and physicians aren't aware of how much money is being added on to pad their bills. So, you know, you have physicians who are saying, look, my income stagnated, we're not getting more from Medicare. And yet, on the other side of the house, all the payers are saying my cost went up 15%, my cost went up 20%. This doesn't make sense, right? A standard financial transaction between a payer and actually being deposited into a bank account of a healthcare provider, that dollar is touched 27 times by 27 different middlemen. You know, that's a lot of bloat, and that's a lot of money that could be going back into our healthcare system, both our clinicians and, you know, social determinants of health, and then back into the hands of the actual employees and employers that are footing the bill.
Were there any other stories or interviews that particularly stuck with you as you were doing the research and as you were writing this book?
You know, I think I tried to add as many personal stories as possible, because, you know, I think that when we all think about ourselves in the position, you know, it's easy to say, you know, for example, you should go get an MRI at this freestanding, you know, clinic for $200 versus going to the hospital for $2,000, right? It's easy to say when it's numbers, but when you are perhaps, you know, somebody that has a mobile, you know, the reason you're there is because your leg's broken and the hospital says, go get your MRI here at the hospital, 200 feet down the hall. I'm not going to blame that individual for doing that, right? So yeah, I think that the more we personalize and humanize the system, which has become very, for lack of a better term, inhumane in many ways, the more we humanize it in storytelling, the more we can communicate the real issues and crisis, I could say, that is facing us in the healthcare system.
What has been the general reaction from, you know, your colleagues and peers after reading the book? Has anyone pulled you aside and, you know, provided some candid feedback for you? What's kind of been the general reaction from some of your colleagues and peers?
So from my colleagues and peers, I've had, you know, nothing but rave reviews, but that is obviously some selective bias, right? I am sure that there are folks that read it and disagree with some of my points, although it would be very difficult to disagree or take issue with the facts that are in the book. So, you know, I've always been told and firmly ascribe to the position that I don't read all the comments. And when it comes to the book, you know, I definitely want to hear candid feedback. But, you know, I don't necessarily want to subject myself to, you know, some of the petty back and forth that happens on like social media and those types of things. And I get that this is a really emotional topic. And some of the things I say are controversial. And again, it's meant to incite discussion and civil dialogue. I think one of the biggest problems we have today is we sit in rooms and we all try to agree with each other. Like, it's okay for you and I to have a disagreement about a particular policy or solution to a problem. But we have to have that hard conversation and we have to ask those hard questions, because without that, we really are going to stay stuck where we are.
Mm-hmm. You've also written on LinkedIn, among other places, about the hidden train in claims data. Can you explain what's happening there and why should clinicians care about how their patients' information is being bought and being sold?
Yeah, so, you know, claims data right now is a very hot topic, at least in my dorky, nerdy circles of healthcare folks. You know, healthcare data is being sold and leveraged by, you know, as I said, all of the middlemen, some of the larger hospitals, revenue cycle management companies, some of these digital health companies. Health data is gold right now, and it's being brokered and used in a way that isn't necessarily helpful for our patients. And, you know, I'll give you an example. When you are geofenced at a hospital, right, you know, entities or companies who have bought that data and bought the right to know that are then able to put information in front of you that is tailored to, you know, all of your other data. So what's happening is they're triangulating consumer data that has been purchased, all the healthcare data that they can buy, and perhaps they're putting a drug ad in front of you that your provider might not necessarily you know, it might not be their first choice or even have occurred to them. But now you think, oh, I need this drug, right? It's just came up on my phone. It came up on my Alexa. It came up, you know, so it's being used, and especially with increasing utilization of AI in some really frightening ways by those companies on the one hand. On the other, employer data and claims data is being denied to the very people that are paying the bills for this care, right? So employers, plan sponsors, and even patients themselves have a very difficult time getting access to information about their own health and their financial well-being that is, you know, loaded and locked into those 200 pages of medical bills. So we definitely have a disconnect, and I spend a lot of my time advocating for better access to those that need access in order to effectively manage, you know, the health, well-being, and financial well-being of patients themselves and the employers that sponsor those benefits.
Speaking of employers, I know you have another book called The Health Plan Turnaround. This one is about fixing, you know, employer-sponsored health coverage. But I think most clinicians never really get to see that side of the system. They really just feel the results, whether that comes in the form of surprise bills or prior authorizations, various network restrictions, out of coverage. So from your perspective, what are the two or three changes that would most quickly relieve pressure on patients and providers?
You know, some of the things that I propose in that book, the workbook, that I think would be helpful to clinicians and patients, the biggest, right, I think is when you do those things and engage in that fiduciary process, care becomes more accessible and affordable because, you know, we don't have to do so much cost shifting, right? Which I'm sure the clinicians listening to this know, it's a huge barrier to care if an individual comes in with a 20% out-of-pocket coinsurance that puts that care out of reach. Or if they come to the office and they haven't been able to get that maintenance medication because of the copays or coinsurance put in front of them, or if they haven't been able to jump through the hoops of that step therapy program that the PBMs implemented and the employer, you know, has no idea. So it's really about keeping the employer on a fiduciary pathway that helps the employer and the employees, you know, again, get greater access to affordable care at the right time, at the right place, for the right price. And I think that that is in the best interest of patients and definitely clinicians.
Yeah, I think that's an important point because I think most physicians don't necessarily see themselves as players when it comes to these types of conversations and these types of decisions around coverage and cost. They kind of just see and feel the effects of the barriers and frustrations in front of them. If we were to take a step back, what is one thing that you think every clinician should understand about how health benefits really work?
Yeah, I think probably most fundamental would be understanding the financial mechanics of, you know, let's say for a self-funded health plan for an employer, and really understanding member cost share. As you said, this isn't typically something that our clinicians and providers have thought about traditionally. But from a health perspective, right, financial aside, from a health perspective, it is very difficult to focus on your, let's say, recovery, you know, cancer recovery, if you're drowning in medical debt and having to consider bankruptcy. There are real health negative consequences for your health if you are not considering the financial aspect of your care. And I'm not saying that, you know, if expensive care should be put off the table, not at all, but clinicians need to be aware of the financial dynamics in order to help their patients both from a, you know, from a financial perspective, but more importantly, from a health perspective, and understanding, like I said, the mechanics of the payment for the care. And, you know, big picture, why is that important? It's important because of this sort of three parties to this transaction, the clinician provider, right, the middleman, the insurance carrier, the PBM, and let's, you know, put the patient and the employer paying for the care. Of those three entities, two of their interests are aligned, and that's the provider and the patient. The provider wants to provide the best care for that patient and keep them well and healthy, and the patient has that incentive as well. So I think the more that we can move closer to those two parties getting to transact more closely, the better off we will all be, both financially and from a healthcare perspective.
Yeah, speaking about how we pay for care, I know you had the opportunity to testify before the U.S. Senate Health Committee about affordable care. What was that experience like?
You know, it was a wonderful experience. I was very honored to be asked by Senator Cassidy to be a witness. And I will say that I've spoken at, you know, Bernie Sanders events before, and I've spoken at, you know, now serving as Cassidy's witness. This is truly a bipartisan issue when it comes to understanding the problems and wanting to solve the problems. I understand that there's varying policy options on how do we fix where we are. But it was immensely gratifying to hear at one point all five of the witnesses, again, who are, you know, from different political affiliations and parties, agree that we need more transparency in the system, that we need less consolidation by the big, you know, big PBMs, big insurance carriers, and big healthcare, if you will. So it was really great to see like some agreement that you don't often get in DC and to be a part of that.
Yeah, that is very encouraging. On this podcast, and in previous episodes, we've talked a lot about burnout and administrative burden and doctors questioning whether they want to stay in traditional practice. I'm curious from your vantage point, which comes from a little bit more of a policy perspective, you know, do you see these types of pressures as signs of a system in crisis, or do you view this more as an opportunity to rebuild something better?
Both. I think is the very lawyerly answer. I think we are simultaneously witnessing a crisis and sort of the decline of an industry standard that has existed for too long, and at the same time, a rebirth at very early stages, but a rebirth of something new that gets back to, you know, putting again, sort of restoring that patient doctor relationship or patient clinician relationship. You know, I think there's a lot of technology and digital tools that can help us get there. But again, I do think that we are witnessing both at the same time. I think it's very difficult to see that now, but I do think, and I hope, you know, that in 10, 20 years, we will look back at this era that we're in, these few years, sort of the post-COVID, if you will, as a time of a time of transition when things really started to both crumble and be rebuilt.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for pulling back the curtain on a part of healthcare I think most of us rarely get to see. For listeners who want to continue following your content, where's the best place to start?
Definitely, you can find me on LinkedIn. I often also link to some Substack articles, though I would say LinkedIn is probably the best place to get me. And I would encourage you on, you know, the Great American Healthcare Heist. It is intended not just for clinicians, not just for healthcare dorks like me. It is really intended to educate our, you know, the entire community, so that when they walk down the street after reading this book, they will never sort of be able to see healthcare the same way again, but in a positive way, in a way that in sort of encourages them to, you know, push for change in a positive way.
Thank you, Chris. This was incredibly enlightening.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks for listening to Curie. A quick reminder that you can catch more conversations like this, along with news, games, and other podcasts over at curie.md. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.